Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Ellie Griffiths, author of the new novel, The Postscript Murders. Ellie, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, it's lovely to be here.
Great to have you. Well, if someone hasn't heard about your new novel yet, how would you describe The Postscript Murders?
Well, The Postscript Murders starts when an elderly lady living in sheltered accommodation and sort of assisted living on the south coast of England dies. And it's very sad, but she's 90 and not in good health, so no one thinks it's very suspicious. And then her carer, a caregiver, goes to clear her flat and finds that the lady whose name was Peggy has lots of crime novels in her house. And what's more, a lot of them are dedicated to Peggy. And some of them say, thanks for the murders. And then the carer finds some business cards describing Peggy as a murder consultant. And that's enough to take her suspicions to the local police, who are first sceptical. But then it turns out that Peggy was actually employed by crime writers as a murder consultant to find gruesome ways for people to die in their books. But when a well-known crime writer dies, it appears that somebody might be killing off crime writers. I think that's all I can say.
Well, I'm curious because I know you've written a number of mystery novels. Do you have a murder consultant that you use?
Well, I don't exactly, but there is a real life counterpoint to Peggy, actually, because I have an Aunt Marge. And since I've been talking about her, I've found that so many people have an Aunt Marge. I don't know why that is. Anyhow, I have an aunt called Marge, and she lives at happily just stay straight away. She's you know, well and with us, still with us. But she lives in sheltered accommodation on the south coast of England. And as soon as she moved there, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was the sea view. Maybe it was the fact that she has a lovely sort of balcony where she can see everything that's going on. But she became kind of, I can only say, sort of obsessed with murder. And she kept thinking of crime plots and she would ring me up. And I'd always know it was her because, you know, not many people use your landline these days. She'd right. always ring on my landline and she'd say, oh, hello, love. I've thought of a good murder for one of your books. So that's really what made me think, you know, what if there was someone whose job that was to think up murders?
And so was that kind of the original idea or impetus that led you to write The Postscript Murders?
Absolutely, yes. I thought, you know, what an idea that there was somebody who was very sort of respectable woman. My aunt is an ex-maths teacher, you know, living in this very respectable town. But what if her job was thinking up gruesome murders? So the plot did start there, really. It started with Auntie Marge on her balcony with her little notebook. She does have a notebook where she writes down unusual things that happen.
So what was your original writing journey that led you to writing and getting your first novel published?
Well, I guess I'm sure it's true of a lot of your guests, actually, in that I always wanted to write, you know, always wanted to write, even before I kind of could write. I used to make these little picture books, you know, so I always wanted to write. When I was 11, I wrote a full-length crime novel, actually. And it was called The Hair of the Dog, which must have been a phrase my parents had used. I don't know if I knew what it meant, but I thought it was a good title. So I always wanted to be a writer. But, you know, you never quite know how to do that, do you? And I suppose I did a lot of the right things in that I read English at university. And then I went to work in a library and eventually worked for a publishing company and actually sort of worked my way up through this publishing company, HarperCollins, to become publishing director for children's fiction. But strangely, that sort of put me off writing myself. I'm not even sure why it was. So it wasn't until I was on maternity leave, and I've got twins, and they're 23. So I guess it was 24 years ago when I was on maternity leave, I suddenly thought, oh, I'm going to try again. I'm going to try and write a book. And that book eventually became my first published book. So like a lot of people, it's a long journey, isn't it? And certainly I wrote a lot of things that weren't published and weren't publishable, I'm sure.
Sure. Well, what is your writing process when you're working on a novel? Since you write mysteries, do you plot extensively before you begin writing?
It's so funny, really, because that has changed for me as I've gone on writing. I've written, I think, 22 books as Ellie Griffiths. I did write before under my real name, which is Domenica De Rosa, which sounds made up, I know. But I've been writing mysteries as Ellie Griffiths for a while now. And I always used, I'm not a great planner. I know some people make amazing sort of spreadsheets, and that's great if that's how you work, you know, but I'm not a great planner. But I always used to do, like, in longhand in my notebook, a chapter plan that went all the way through the book. And I would, you know, work it all out and work out who did it. But for the last four books, which, funny enough, I think have had my most complex plots, I haven't actually written anything down. I have had a plot, I have had an idea, and it's been in my head and it's changed a little as I've gone along. And I don't know if that's because I've got a bit more confident now, you know, I've sort of got confident that I can work it out. And I don't even know if it'll carry on like that. But it's funny how that has changed. And there's a very good quote I'm trying to remember. I think it's by E.L. Doctorow. And he said something like, writing a book is like taking a journey in the dark with your headlights on. You can only see a little way in front, but you can make the whole journey that way. And I think that's now how I write, if that makes sense.
Yes, yes, it does. And I'm curious about that. When you start thinking about a new book, I mean, you know, because you do tend to be prolific, do you start thinking about it while you're writing your previous book? And do you write anything down at this point, or are you just in your head kind of thinking like, that would be a good idea?
Well, sort of a bit of both, really. I can't really write two books at the same time, though I know some people can. But I'm sort of only writing one book at a time, but I'm often thinking about the next one. And, you know, if I do get an idea, I have a little notebook again always with me, and I sort of jot down an idea. And ideas do go round in my head. But sometimes I will, you know, finish one book. And as you say, I have been, I think, quite prolific over the last few years. I've published two books a year. Sometimes I have sat down at my desk and just thought, I've got to start the book today. And I have always started it, even if there's not much of an idea. So again, it's a little bit about just trusting that the ideas do come. Sometimes there's not much in my head when I sit down to start writing it.
Wow. So I'm curious, you talked about you worked your way up at HarperCollins before you started your career as a novelist. I'm curious, what has been your experience, given your knowledge of publishing, now that you're kind of on the other side as an author?
It's funny, isn't it? You'd think it would be more helpful than it is, actually. You know, you'd think that, you know, I would really understand everything about how publishing works. I guess, you know, there are some things I do understand that maybe a first-time author wouldn't understand. But, you know, publishing has changed as well a lot in the last 20-odd years since I was there. And also, you know, you forget how kind of needy you feel as a writer. You sort of want your editor to tell you that it's all okay. And you sort of can't tell yourself that, you know. I wish I could, but I'm really dependent. I'm one of those people, I don't show my book to anyone when I'm working on it. So the first person to see is my editor, Jane, who's edited everything that I've written. And so I'm very dependent on her, and I can't sort of edit it myself. You know, I also need Jane to tell me whether it's any good at first, but then I need her to work on it with me and say things like, you know, you always get those moments where your editor says, is it still Thursday? Because everything seems to have happened on Thursday. Or someone gets in a car and a skirt and gets out in trousers and things like that. And I do need an editor for that. So it hasn't really helped in that way. I still really need an editor. But I guess it has helped me manage expectations. I know how hard it is to get on in publishing. And I know how many books are published. So I guess I think I'm an easy-ish author to work with. And that, one, I do understand deadlines, so I've never been late. And two, I kind of do know how hard it is for a book to do really well.
Yes. Well, what writing advice would you offer for those who are listening who are working on their own stories or novels?
I guess I would say, a bit as I was saying earlier about sort of sitting down at your desk and knowing you have to start, I would sort of say, don't wait for inspiration. You know, I would say, sit down and start writing, and then inspiration comes. Sometimes inspiration comes at the end. You know, you don't have to have a killer idea, you know, to write a book. So I would say, start writing. Try and write every day. I know it's really hard, and you know, I'm lucky in that I'm not doing a full-time job. Many writers are. So try and write every day. I try and write 1,000 words a day, which isn't that much really, but it does, you know, in that way you hope that in 90 days you'll have something like a book. And that's the other bit of advice. I would say keep going until you've got a manuscript. Somebody once said to me at the beginning of my sort of writing career that you can fix a bad page, but you can't fix a blank page. And that's always stayed with me. So write something down. So then you'll have a manuscript that you can edit and you can work on. So I would say start writing and try and finish. I know that sounds very, very obvious, but it's not that obvious, really.
Great. Well, what novels or nonfiction books have you read recently that you enjoyed?
Well, I'm sure like all your listeners and guests, I am quite a prolific reader. I read all the time. I love reading some historical fiction, all sorts of fiction. Recently, I've read a very good book by a British author called Will Dean, called The Last Thing to Burn. And that's going to, I think it's only just come out in the US, but it is out in the US. And it's a very tense novel about a woman who's basically held prisoner. And it's really, it's one of those books, it's not a very long book, and you're happy it's not long, because you sort of can't bear that level of tension. But I thought that was really, really good. I think it, you know, should, if there's any justice, make Will a big star. And another book that I really enjoyed recently was by Erin Kelly, and it was called Watch Her Fall. And it was about ballet. It was about murder amongst ballet dancers. And like a lot of people, when I was young, I read ballet books. And it's kind of like a grown-up version of a ballet book where everyone starts killing each other. So I would really recommend that one as well.
Well, are you working on a new novel now?
Yes, I'm working on the 14th book in my Dr. Ruth Galloway series. So I write a series of books about a forensic archaeologist who helps the police solve crimes. My husband's an archaeologist, I'm really interested in archaeology. And they're set in Norfolk, which I don't know if you know Norfolk. It's on the east coast of England. It's very beautiful, but quite sort of desolate in parts, quite sort of lonely part of England. And there's loads of archaeology there. So they're set there. So I'm working on book 14 in that series, and it's called The Locked Room. And it, because I've published one of those books a year for the last, well, 14 years, I have now got to the point of 2020, and it is going to take place during lockdown. I did think about whether I should do that or not, and I decided to do it. So it's called The Locked Room, and if I finish it in time, it should be out next year.
So forensic archaeology. So what do you, are there things that you specifically read in terms of like looking for ideas that have to do with forensic archaeology? I mean, are you reading journals, or are you talking with your husband about ideas?
Yes, I don't really talk to him about the books as much as you'd think, really. He did give me the sort of inspiration to have the idea, but it's not kind of, I don't sort of ask him for advice, but he has introduced me to lots of wonderful archaeologists, so I do ask for advice. Yes, so I read archaeology papers. I read, I love reading some nonfiction books about archaeology, but I follow a lot of archaeologists as well. It's a wonderful thing nowadays, isn't it, on Twitter and Instagram, and you can sort of be part of the conversation. I'm a member of Sussex Archaeology, and so, you know, in happier times we could go on digs together, but now there are lots of sort of online groups, and you can find such fascinating conversations about, you know, I don't know, about artifacts and stone tools, things I would never have thought I would be interested in. And I think for me the interesting thing about forensic archaeologists and archaeologists generally is that they sort of dig down through the layers, and they can read the landscape, and they can look at landscape, and they can say, oh, you know, that little hill, well, that's a barrow, that's a burial site. And sometimes they say things that really you do make your blood run cold. That I heard recently, and I know I put it in a book, an archaeologist say that if there are nettles in your garden, there could be a body. Because you only get nettles, I think, when there's been human activity. So it needs to be a body, but it could be a body. You know, you don't get nettles without humans. And that certainly made me look at my garden in a different way.
That's great. Well, where can people find you online if they want to learn more about you and your novels?
Oh, well, great. They can. I've got a website, which is www.elliegriffiths. I'm also on Twitter as Ellie Griffiths. And I absolutely love hearing from readers. I've got an Ellie Griffiths Facebook page, and I'm on Instagram as Ellie Griffiths. So any of those ways, I just really love to hear from people, really. And if you like my book, so much the better.
That's wonderful. Well, again, we've been speaking with Ellie Griffiths, author of the new novel, The Postscript Murders. The novel is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And Ellie, thanks for doing this interview.
Oh, thanks so much, Jeff. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Now, stay tuned for a brief excerpt from the audiobook of The Postscript Murders by Ellie Griffiths, available wherever audiobooks are sold.
HMH Audio presents The Postscript Murders, written by Ellie Griffiths, read by Nina Wadia.
Prologue. The two men have been standing there for 18 minutes. Peggy has been timing them on her stopwatch. They parked on the seafront just in front of Benedict's Cafe. A white Ford Fiesta. Annoyingly, she can't see the registration, but if she uses her binoculars, she can see a dent on the near side door. If they have hired the car, the company will have taken a note of this. Peggy makes a note too, getting out her investigation book, which is cunningly disguised as a seaside lady's diary, complete with saccharine watercolours of shells and fishing boats. There are several reasons why Peggy finds the men suspicious. They look out of place in Shoreham-by-Sea, for one thing. Sometimes, just for fun, and to keep her observational powers honed, Peggy makes an inventory of people who have walked past her window. Monday, September 3rd, 2018, 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. 7 times pensioners, 2 couples, 3 singles. 1 times man on roller skates, 30s, too old. 4 times singles with dogs, 2 times collie crosses, 1 times pug, 1 times doodle. People always remember dogs. Woman, 30s, smartly dressed, talking on phone. Man, 60s, carrying black bin liner, probably homeless. 4 times cyclists, 2 times male joggers, 1 fit-looking, 1 looking on verge of collapse. 1 times unicyclist, probably from Brighton. The men outside her window do not fit this pattern. They're not cycling, jogging, or accompanied by dogs. They are not pensioners. They are probably mid to late 30s, with short hair, wearing jeans and short jackets, 1 blue, 1 grey. What would young people call them? Bomber jackets? An ill-starred name if she ever heard one. The men look similar because of the way they're dressed, but Peggy doesn't think that they are related. One is much darker skinned than the other and built differently, compact rather than wiry. She doesn't think they're lovers either. They don't touch or look at each other. They aren't laughing or arguing, the two best ways to spot if people are a couple. They're just standing there, maybe waiting for something. Occasionally, the one in the blue jacket looks up at the flats, but Peggy keeps back behind the curtains. She's very good at disappearing into the background. All old people are. At first, she wondered if the bomber jackets had driven over especially for Benedict's coffee, which is excellent, but the men don't move towards the shack. There's an alertness about them that Peggy finds most troubling of all, and they both have their backs to the sea. Who comes to Shoreham Beach and doesn't even glance at the shimmering water, looking at its very best today, dotted with sailing boats and accessorized with seagulls? But the crop-haired duo are facing the road and Seaview Court, the block of retirement flats where Peggy is currently lurking in a bay window. There's no doubt about it. The men are waiting for something. But what? At 11:05 precisely, Blue Jacket takes out his phone and speaks to someone. Grey Jacket looks at his watch, which is a chunky thing, visible through her binoculars, even at 100 yards away. The two men confer and get back into their car. The Fiesta pulls out into the road, and Peggy leans forward to get the registration number. GY something. Is that a 1 or a 7? She needs to go to the optician's and get her prescription changed. Then the car stops just outside her window. Peggy leans back into her curtains, which are loosely woven cotton. So loose that she can see through the weave. It's a little blurry, but she thinks that one of the men is leaning out of the window taking photographs. Off Seaview Court. The Fiesta revs up and it's gone. 11:07.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.